All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 podcast, where Bryce and Pizza Mind, my notorious compadre, are leading you all through Crypt Nation. Pete, how are we doing this morning? You look lovely.
I feel lovely, Bryce, and that's because I have actually started to eat keto. Don't worry, I haven't forsaken pizza, but I've changed over to this cauliflower kind of crust, which sounds terrible, but it's actually not that bad depending on where you get it from. I still get that cheesy goodness, but without that lagging effect that really clouds my judgment.
And that's the crazy thing, because when you told me you were going keto, I said, Pete, we've known each other forever, and I've never seen you eat a vegetable. Now you're telling me you're going to eat cauliflower pizza. Pete, I'm scared that your body won't be able to process vegetable enzymes. And how did it go? You know, without being too graphic.
All I feel is much more energy. That's the only effect it's had on me so far. I feel like I'm about 10 years younger. But I will have a cheat real pizza every now and then. But what I really want to talk about is, you know, they talk about new year, new me. Crypto is like new quarter, new me. Every quarter is so vastly different. This thing's open 24/7. It's the Wild West. But we're seeing a lot of evolution almost as fast as Singapore's development. That's how fast crypto has been moving in Q2. So today with us in the studio, live and in person, we have Joshua Frank from the Thai, who has written with Guy Hirsch of eToro, a quarterly report. Guy is with us from
New York.
In Israel. Oh my goodness. So we've got everyone from all over the place here. We're going to be talking about quarter two and all the crazy things that have happened then. Guy, Josh, welcome to Crypto 101.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Awesome. So guys, we're going to go ahead and we're going to jump in real quick. But for anybody who hasn't met you before, Guy, give us a quick high-level overview of your role over at eToro. And, you know, I think you've got a really interesting story of actually how you came into the industry. So catch us up, give us some background, and then we'll jump into the report.
Sure. So I've been with eToro since December of 2017. I'm the U.S. Managing Director. My job is to build and grow the eToro business in the U.S. The what you kind of mentioned there is one of my early interactions, business interactions with crypto or with Bitcoin more specifically, was when I was leading the retail innovation program for Samsung North America. We're talking 2014. And I was trying to convince Samsung as part of, I was developing a point of sale system at the time. That was supposed to be used in a concept store in Soho. And I was trying to convince them to accept Bitcoin as a form of basically being competitive to Apple stores and be the first to be able to sell phones and accept Bitcoin. And I wasn't successful, obviously, but that was the genesis of my business interest in crypto, and it grew ever since.
Awesome. Well, you've been a frontier or a pioneer of the frontier here for a long time. And Mr. Joshua Frank, live and in person with us today in the studio. You do so much in the industry. You don't just write reports. You don't just collect massive amounts of sentiment data and market data. You really just run the gamut. So give us a high level overview before we dive into the state of the market report that you and Guy have just been working on for the past several months. Who are you, and how'd you kind of find yourself getting into crypto?
Yeah, thanks again for having me on. So yeah, I was working at a boring traditional financial technology job and was trading cryptocurrency on the side in early 2017, as well building sophisticated models to trade equities using sentiment data. Kind of put two and two together, was like, hey, you know, if you can take social data to predict the movement of traditional assets that have fundamentals, you know, for example, Microsoft has revenue and dividends, well then you can take that same data and bring it into crypto, where there's nothing fundamentally driving the value of these assets. And that's kind of how I, you know, got into the space, started the tie, you know, focusing initially on sentiment data, which is a massive, massive part of our business and what we do, but have since expanded to build out, you know, SigDev, which is the first, you know, corporate actions feed for crypto, which basically alerts everybody from the biggest publications in crypto to hedge funds, to regulators, to law firms about the most actionable and important information in the space. But we provide a variety of things, but very much focused on making data actionable for investors. So there's a lot of focus in the space on information and just providing a bevy of information to individuals and to institutions in the space. Whereas our focus is really on taking that information and making it actionable.
So Guy, let me pose a question to you because Josh said something quite interesting. And I'm not sure how you think of this, but he says crypto doesn't have any fundamental drivers of demand, right? There's no fundamentals. Do you agree with that statement? And if you do or if you don't, tell us what, you know, what really does drive crypto price action if there are no dividends or earnings or stock splits to really trade off of?
I think Bitcoin is a movement. Bitcoin is part of a movement, and the people who were early contributors to the protocol, the people who were notified by it, by Satoshi Nakamoto, they were trying to build something like this for decades. They were trying to figure out a way to basically exit current financial systems, create something that's pseudo-anonymous, that would allow people to freely transact outside of the realms of governments, outside of the realms of regulators, as a way to accomplish some sort of a, you know, libertarian utopia in a way. So Bitcoin is a movement, and the reason you had so many smart people already ready to get going on this, ready to contribute, ready to do what's necessary to try to build it, is what gave it value. And still, I believe is the driver behind this. And so, you know, to your question, I think that is the fundamental asset, the fundamental, I would say, driver behind the success of Bitcoin and this industry as a whole. But if you try to look at it as an asset class in traditional financial kind of analytics lenses, you would remiss the understanding what is happening here. Because I think that in a traditional sense, there are no fundamentals here. There are no fundamentals here. It's something that is completely different. It's an uncorrelated asset. There is no quarterly reports to you know, like a publicly traded company. There's no team. There's no centralized org that you can evaluate really the best predictor, not the fundamental, but the best predictor to price movement is what Josh is working on, which is sentiment analysis, which has been proven to be, I would say, the best available predictor for a price movement. But there are no fundamentals here. The real fundamental here is a group of people who believe in a different future, who created this or contributed this, and they trust this to be just a better way for society to deal with money. And more people believe that this is indeed the case. And this is why we see Bitcoin being successful after so many years and still around and still going strong.
Yeah. In fact, I would even say that the number one fundamental metric in crypto and Bitcoin is people. People simply look at how many user wallets are there. Are they active? And that's what makes people excited, or that's what makes them disinterested, is how many people are involved in this. And we've seen some very powerful people get involved in this past quarter. We saw Paul Tudor Jones announce that he's actually involved in Bitcoin. He's one of the biggest investors in the world. We saw one of the biggest VCs in the world, Andreessen Horowitz, raise another $500 million Bitcoin fund.
With a B?
With a B. That's right, billion. 550 million is how much they raised. That was over their initial goal. So with those two things, there are so many reasons to be excited about Bitcoin. Josh, what other things are you seeing that have happened in Q2 that make you believe that Bitcoin's actually here to stay? It's not just a fad.
Yeah, so I think you hit on, you know, two of the bigger, I would say, developments for Bitcoin in you know, this past quarter. But I think what we saw more broadly is a series of iterative improvements to infrastructure, to support, you know, that have kind of laid the groundwork for this giant Bitcoin rally that we're seeing today. You know, I think when CME futures were launched in late 2017, and Bitcoin ran up to $20,000, I think in large part due to people's excitement about institutional interest in the space, you know, people thought there was going to be this massive, massive wave of every institution coming, traditional institutions, pensions, hedge funds, family offices. And that didn't really happen. But what we've seen happen is it's come in waves, right? And it's kind of, you know, trickling in, right? And we've seen a few more of those trickles with PayPal and Venmo, which is absolutely massive. And I'd love to have Guy talk about this in a second, you know, rolling out crypto buying and selling. To your point, Andreessen, you know, this wasn't their first fund. This is their second fund. So they came into crypto, invest in the space very early. They were very early believers in crypto and have now doubled down with an oversubscribed fund, you know, $515 million. You know, you also have Fidelity coming out and saying, you know, a third of big institutions own crypto assets. So I think the biggest thing about Q2 is the fact that we've seen iterative improvements, which have added up and made a massive impact. But not only that, you know, over the last few years, the biggest thing about Bitcoin is the fact that it's still here. That after all the shit, for lack of better words, that it's gone through, right? After the flash crash, after, you know, falling from highs of $20,000 down to $3,000, right? Going up and down, after Jamie Dimon a few years ago saying that Bitcoin is a scam, after seeing articles about, you know, the US government cracking down on illicit activity in crypto, after Goldman coming out and saying cryptos are not an asset class, the fact that Bitcoin's still here and today, you know, as we're talking, it's over $11,000. I mean, that's massive, and that's a testament to the fact, to everything that everybody was saying before, that people believe in Bitcoin and people are the reason that crypto is here.
Powerful, powerful, powerful stuff. So Guy, tell us a little bit about, from your perspective, this PayPal announcement. You know, they've got 325 million customers worldwide. You used to work pretty closely with point of sales systems and merchants. Tell us a little bit about, from your perspective, is this the real deal? Is this what crypto needs? Is this good? Overall, what's your takeaway from that?
Short answer is absolutely. It is good. It is another validation. It will bring Bitcoin and crypto in general to millions more, probably. And so the short answer is absolutely, this is a good thing. I believe that what happened is they saw a competitor, Cash App, being extremely successful, morphing its business model from a peer-to-peer, basically, you know, kind of payment app into a more holistic value prop that allowed its customers to also buy Bitcoin and then later buy stocks. And I'm sure they saw that more and more of what they used to consider is their kind of bread and butter flocked into Cash App and decided that they cannot stay on the fence, but they have to join the party. I think Venmo is interesting in the sense that it's a social payment app. And that would be very interesting to see the implementation of Bitcoin purchases or trading in Venmo directly, because then your friends will be able to see that you just bought Bitcoin. And that potentially has a lot of, I would say, value to the industry, because then more and more people would see that their friends are buying Bitcoin or paying each other maybe even with Bitcoin. And that would be, I think, you know, immensely valuable. And lastly, I would say that it is another step in the right direction of moving the world into a into using either Bitcoin or stable coins or, you know, whatever the case may be, in order to transact cross border, in order to be able to send money instantaneously or almost instantaneously, and for a fraction of the cost that is being paid right now, from one country to from one country to another country. I believe that that is kind of the key use case right now. And Josh and I will probably talk more about this in terms of adoption for this industry in the form of stable coins. But the fact that PayPal is now entering into the space will make only, in my opinion, only good things to the industry as a whole.
Definitely. And let's talk about stable coins. Because when I grew up, I was not taught anything about investing. I was taught to save my money. And when someone told me about Bitcoin and other very volatile assets, to some people listening out there, and myself included at first, that was not attractive. That was scary. I didn't want the possibility of gambling with money that I needed to pay bills or send to my family or friends in another country. I wanted something that I knew was going to be safe and stable. So with stable coins, you've got these digital assets that are synthetic. They represent an actual dollar that's in a bank account or a vault somewhere. So their price is actually stable. But what's happened is now you've got this thing that mimics your savings account in a bank, but there are vehicles that allow you to put your stable coins to work and earn far more than a bank could ever possibly pay you because they've cut out all the middlemen. So people that are conservative with their funds and their investing can actually take part in this crypto revolution. We've seen more stable coins come online with more companies and more ways to earn in Q2 than ever before, with yield farming and suites of different stable coins in different currencies. We saw the rise of the Celo network come online. We've seen synthetics jump into, you know, the top 30. They're synthesizing all kinds of different assets, including US dollars. Josh, what are some of the ways that you see stable coins changing the game? And what are some companies that maybe are overlooked, other than, you know, everyone in crypto knows what Tether is, of course. But what are some other stable coins and some other products out there that people should pay attention to? What are some ways to use stable coins to create profits in a safe manner?
Yeah, so I'm actually not interested in the interest generating part of stable coins. I think it is great that now you can go to a centralized platform like BlockFi or like Celsius. You can lend out a stable coin, which is tethered to the value of the US dollar, and you can earn a significantly higher amount of interest on that deposit. That said, there are significant risks associated with lending your capital to centralized and decentralized finance platforms. And I'm not giving any sort of recommendations as to any individual platforms where to put your money. But in the report, what we cover is the fact that yield generation is great, but what's going to drive long-term mainstream adoption is actually foreign remittances. So if you look, you know, right now in the US, right, we're all sitting here in the US. I know guys in Israel, but if you want to send money to your friend on Venmo or the Cash App, it's awesome. It's super free. It's easy. You can send it 24/7. But when you're a foreign worker in a different country and you have to send money home, that's incredibly, incredibly difficult and expensive. On average, at banks across the globe, the average fee to send money home is 11%. So if you're a foreign domestic worker in Hong Kong with $218 in discretionary income a month, you're sending home about $25 out of the entire $218 that you have to send home every single month. And that's a massive, massive, massive problem. And so if you think about this, you may be like, oh, well, you know, a domestic worker in Hong Kong sending money back to the Philippines is not a big deal. But if you actually look at the industry, global remittances are a $700 billion. They're almost a $1 trillion industry globally. And they're now approaching to be the largest source of external financing to many of the world's developing countries. So there is more financing, you know, then foreign aid, which comes through remittances, right? Then donations, which is absolutely massive, $700 billion. And so, you know, we've seen a movement towards mobile banking and mobile payments, which have reduced the cost of farmer minces down to about 3%, but that's still absurdly high. And, you know, a lot of us like to talk about Bitcoin, and, you know, the original idea back in the day was Bitcoin as, you know, a means of a method of payment. And we've seen that there are problems with that, right? You know, it's expensive to send money on the Bitcoin network. It's slow, but stable coins, on the other hand, are a massive, massive, massive opportunity. On Ethereum, you know, people complain about gas fees on Ethereum. Right now, the average gas fee on Ethereum is 35 cents and it takes 6 minutes to send a transaction. 35 cents is a lot less than going to your bank and sending and paying 11% to send money back home. But not only are you able to send money back home fastly and cheaply, in many cases, foreign workers send money back home to countries with high inflation. And what they can do now is they can send money, they can send USDC, they can send USDT, hopefully eventually they can send Libra, right? And they can send all these different stable coins that don't necessarily have to be tied to the value of the US dollar. They can be tied to the value of other advanced economies. They can send that capital home. And now all of a sudden, the person, you know, the family member receiving that isn't receiving a Pakistani rupee, which inflates by 20 or 30% a year. They're receiving a US dollar equivalent, and they can convert that to their local currency as need be. So it's an amazing system that solves an actual real world use case that isn't, you know, looking for yield. Every other use case for crypto to this point has basically been looking for yield. And we're super excited because this isn't that. So, you know, the question that you guys may have is, how does this positively affect crypto, right? Okay, it's great that somebody has some stable coin that doesn't really make any money that they're sending back home, but how does that affect crypto? Well, it does in a bunch of different ways. The first way is if you look at the FAT protocol thesis, which was proposed by Joel Monegro, who was at Union Square Ventures, now at Placeholder. Basically, the idea that when the internet was created, all the value accrued at the application layer, right? It didn't accrue at the TCP/IP, HTTP layers. It accrued at your Googles, right? And your AOLs and your Yahoo layers. But in crypto, what we're seeing is a lot of the value is accruing to the protocol level. The value is accruing to Ethereum, right? You have a lot of these networks built on Ethereum, and, you know, Chainlink is becoming absolutely massive on top of Ethereum, but Ethereum is still the dominant player, right? The majority of the value on the network is accruing to Ethereum. So if you believe in the fact that if a ton of stuff is built on a network, the value will accrue to that network token, well then if stablecoins become a $500 billion freaking industry, right, all that value is going to accrue to the networks. You know, Omni, Tether is built on Bitcoin, right? And Tether is issued on Ethereum, and there's a Tether issued on Tron, right? So all the value is going to accrue to that network. But beyond that, and most importantly, it's a fiat on-ramp, right? Once people, you know, start buying USDC, it is way easier for them to then convert that money into Bitcoin, right? They don't have to go onto an exchange and convert their US dollar into USDC into Bitcoin. They have that USDC to start with. And if we can capture 0.5% of global remittances, that's like $3 billion a year from 0.5% of an industry that has a huge problem that this can solve.
Fascinating. Just kind of touch on that same point. I saw an interesting statistic the other day, whereby it showed the market capitalization of Ethereum was just finally surpassed by the market cap of all the different ERC-20 or applications built on top of Ethereum. So I've always been a proponent of the FAT protocol thesis as well. I thought it was a really cool idea, but seeing all the applications on top, like, you know, an aggregate of all that, start to surpass the market cap of the app, the protocol, it just has me thinking, you know, is that narrative really as strong as we might think? But anyhow, that's just a side comment. I want to kind of go do a deep dive and start looking at some of the social metrics that you guys were looking at. One of the key narratives that you guys were defining for quarter two was Bitcoin's social activity trends that are inferring institutions are coming. And so everybody in crypto is always thinking about the institutions are coming. You know, Main Street was in before Wall Street, all that kind of stuff. But you guys have more data than any other crypto company in regards to social media. So tell me, Josh, what kinds of indicators did you see that institutions truly are coming? And are they just coming for Bitcoin, or are they coming for anything else?
Well, so I think even before, getting into that, I think, you know, the last, you know, up until this point, the majority of crypto's movement has very much been driven by retail. And retail is very much narrative driven, right? And social sentiment is very much narrative driven. And we kind of saw, you know, the coronavirus narrative being a massive thing for Bitcoin and, you know, Bitcoin being a hedge against inflation. But what we're seeing is kind of a decrease in the number of conversations around the coronavirus. And the same thing goes with the halving, right? We saw these massive inflows of conversations around, you know, the halving, you know, tweet volume went up above 50,000 tweets a day for the first time in a few years. And Bitcoin's price, you know, blew up to $11,000 or $10,500, whatever it was for a few minutes. But after that, throughout Q2, and we're obviously seeing more conversations now, given, you know, this more recent price movement above $10,000, but there really wasn't a dominant social trend that had occurred in Q2. But what we did see is the market cap of Bitcoin continued to increase, right? I think Bitcoin went up by 40% quarter over quarter without any major increase in social activity. So one metric that we've created, which is inspired by the NVT ratio from Willy Wu, is the NV tweet ratio. And basically what that does, it takes the market cap of a coin and it divides it by the 30-day average tweet volume. So basically it looks at how the market is valuing a cryptocurrency as a multiple of its social activity. And what we saw is that Bitcoin's NV tweet ratio increased by 71% over Q2 to basically an all-time high. So in other words, now people are valuing Bitcoin at the highest multiple of the number of people talking about it than ever before. And to us, that's kind of a sign, you know, in conjunction with like Bitcoin options, open interest, you know, blowing up, that institutions are here, right? This isn't purely a retail-driven rally. You know, we see it with Paul Tudor Jones, with Andreessen, and with others, and with Rentech have filings saying that they're, you know, now touching crypto. You know, the fact that it's not just, you know, a retail social media-driven rally, there's actually some institutions here, which is kind of being proven in the data by the fact that, you know, there isn't a spike in social conversations coinciding with this rise in price.
Today's show is brought to you by our new sponsor, Cog Network. Cog Network, geared for gain.
Cog Network is hedge fund investing evolved.
By owning Cog Network tokens, you get exposure to the hedge fund's gains. The hedge fund is comprised of algorithmically traded commodity futures and investment in hard assets related to energy. The first hard asset is partial ownership of a multi-million dollar solar farm that has a crypto mining operation attached.
I mean, this is really something that both traditional and crypto investors can come together and participate in. So for traditional investors, they can get exposure to cutting-edge blockchain technology in a framework that they're familiar with, a hedge fund, right? And crypto investors can get exposure to an actual security that bears dividends and includes non-crypto assets.
So that's super cool. And just for full disclosure, Cog Network is a fully registered and regulated entity qualified by the SEC as a Reg D as well as a Reg S and has a 506C exemption. They've been working with lawmakers since 2017 to get this idea built out in a fully compliant way.
Crypt Nation, if you guys are interested in learning more about a tokenized hedge fund, go visit www.cog.network.
Let's talk about US retail, because the world's already on to Bitcoin. Us here in the U.S., we've got the U.S. dollar. People think, well, do we really even need Bitcoin? Well, for the very first time, a lot of people are waking up to this idea after the government's printing literally trillions of dollars out of thin air that's backed by nothing. They're saying, hey, maybe Bitcoin was right about this. Guy, what inflows are you seeing over the eToro ever since the first stimulus package came out? I mean, when it comes to retail investing, eToro is as a household name as anything is. What are you seeing over there in terms of new users? And what kind of features are they asking for in terms of support and education?
That's a great question. I think what we saw globally is, and by the way, I just wanted to kind of premise the answer, is that globally, eToro did a massive marketing push this year around our commission-free stock trading offering. And so we were promoting this very aggressively outside of the US and asking people to join eToro and trade stocks commission-free in, you know, in more than 100 countries where we are where we are live. So that was done, and But still, at the end of Q2, we still saw that the most most traded asset at eToro globally is Bitcoin. It's still Bitcoin. So people came in, they because of the commission-free stock trading offering. So they may bought Tesla, they may bought some other stock, but they still bought Bitcoin. And I feel that is because a younger generation is aware of the risk of inflation, is aware of what's happening with money printing and governments worldwide being, sometimes irresponsible with regards to monetary policy.
Right.
And they just buy the asset because they have some sort of an understanding that this is a hedge, some sort of a hedge. Maybe they are not, very sophisticated investors, but they get it on a very high level. And so they buy the asset. They believe that this is a hedge. They believe that they can also get some alpha because it's an uncorrelated asset. And so the possibility of returns might be there. So we still see Bitcoin as the most popular asset on eToro. That to me is fascinating.
And I'd love to add to that. I mean, the fact that, just look at how badly the US government has botched the coronavirus response. Why do you trust them with your money? Right? Like, I mean, we're printing trillions and 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 trillions of dollars. Right? Exactly. I don't even know how many times I said it, but it's an unbelievable amount of money. Governments around the globe, especially the US, has completely botched this. Our Congress can't agree on anything, right? And look, I still have most of my money in US dollars, right? And I think, that's still probably, the more, I guess, responsible thing that the average person would say. But that said, I have a percentage of my capital in Bitcoin because it makes sense as a hedging asset, right? It makes sense to hold an amount of money in Bitcoin because it has over the last in its lifetime been the best performing asset and has continually in 2020 for example outperformed the S&P 500, outperformed gold, outperformed the Nasdaq, outperformed other stocks, right? So there's a big argument to be made and reason why people are putting their money in Bitcoin and potentially other digital assets.
Fascinating. I think that's spot on, man. And just like a little anecdote, a lot of the times people, for the past, 3-4 years that, crypto has kind of been, I guess exposed to the mainstream. Everybody in my family or my friends or my girlfriend, they always discounted it until March of 2020 when they started saying to me, well, where does money come from? Well, how does what does it mean that the government's printing trillions of dollars? Well, where's the government getting all of this money from for stimulus and all that kind of stuff? And then when it was happening in real time, they finally woke up and said, oh, I get it. I get why you like Bitcoin so much, because it's immune to this whole idea of money printing. So that's just a thing that I think hits home for a lot of people. So I'm glad that we could kind of harp on that for a little while. But moving on to DeFi, I know, DeFi is surging. PizzaMine knows DeFi is surging, but some people are completely in the dark on this. I want to ask you, Josh, how big is DeFi compared to the actual real traditional financial space, and kind of paint it as a backdrop of, how early we are for anybody who's investing in DeFi?
Yeah, so I don't know if my DeFi answers are the answers you guys are going to want to hear, given the backdrop of that question. Look, DeFi is very, very small. It is negligible compared. It is all of DeFi is smaller than Paul Tudor Jones's net worth, just for perspective, right? It's 1% of Jeff Bezos' net worth, right? DeFi is tiny, right? It's nothing in comparison to the rest of, the traditional financial system. That said, it is absolutely surging, right? Total value locked in DeFi protocols went up by 150% in Q2. if we look at, you know, mentions of DeFi in cryptocurrency headlines, DeFi was actually the fifth most mentioned topic in cryptocurrency publications in Q2. So it was Bitcoin, crypto, Ethereum, blockchain, and then DeFi in terms of mentions in headlines. So it has become a very, very, very large part of the conversation within the crypto community. And we're seeing that with, you know, with Balancer and with Curve and with, you know, YFI and with, you know, all these, you know, decentralized, you know, finance, you know, protocols that are just, you know, seeing these massive bull runs and going up in some cases by 100,000% in like a week, which doesn't make any sense, but that's a different story. But anyways, you know, DeFi is growing. It's seeing this massive surge, but it is in a very small community, right? If you look at, you know, DeFi is the fifth most mentioned word in crypto publications, but there were only 4 total news stories from all publications that were not crypto related mentioning DeFi in Q2. Just 4. For comparison, there were 200 mentioning Bitcoin. So it is still a very, very small percentage of you know, the space. And if we look at, you know, at the end of Q2, for example, there were only 7,000 active addresses holding Compound. You know, the market cap surged to $502 million, but it was, you know, 7,000 active addresses. And in many cases, holders will have, you know, multiple addresses. And I'm sure you guys have multiple addresses for some of your tokens, right? So it is still a very, very small community. There are still very legitimate concerns with the community. You know, the fact that a lot of this code is not audited. These protocols have been hacked. I mean, I think we pulled the data in our quarterly report. Balancer was hacked on June 29th. There was a hack on June 18th. There was a hack on April 27th. There was DeForce lost $25 million on April 19th. There was another hack on April 19th. I mean, that's 5 major DeFi hacks just in Q2. So there are serious concerns. You know, with yield farming, there are great ways of earning ridiculous amounts of interest, but the risks have to be taken into consideration. And also the fact that it is not easy to access these platforms, and Katie kind of talks about that in the report. You know, it's not easy to onboard to a DeFi platform. So I am not of the opinion that this is mainstream. I'm more of the opinion that this is a bubble.
Right. And that is actually pretty close to the answer I was looking for. I was just trying to show how small this segment of the industry really is. There's so much growth opportunity. I don't know. What do you think, Pete?
Yeah. Now, if you wanted to have your money double in Amazon stock, it's already worth like, what, $100 trillion or something like that?
It's like $1.5 trillion.
$1.5 trillion. It would have to go up another $1 trillion. That's basically Fed printing level for it to double. But in DeFi, for it to double, that could literally happen overnight and sometimes does. So yes, there are risks associated with it, with using the platforms, but there's lots of tokens that you can simply buy and hold in your own wallet, in your own custody as well, and take advantage of some of this growth. And that's why Bitcoin's so attractive, I think, to people of our generation. It has much more opportunity to grow from less than 1% adoption to actually becoming part of the rest of the world. And I think hopefully we're going to see that pretty soon. Guy, what are your thoughts coming from eTor over there on the DeFi movement? Is this technology, rather than the crazy yields, but is this technology something that a huge centralized platform like eToro could potentially integrate somewhere down the line? What do you find interesting about all the different things that people are doing in DeFi?
Right. So yes, I think eToro is fundamentally building bridges between the old world and the new world. We're part of enabling that transition into a world that would, I believe, inevitably would be decentralized. So with all these, basically the hopes and dreams of those who are currently building DeFi projects is where we would eventually go. I saw a talk by Balaji Srinivasan at Stanford, where he talked about, you know, the ultimate exit of Silicon Valley. So you can, to make it short, he said, you can either, if you want to innovate, you can either try to have a voice, that is to work within a system, or you can just exit and just don't worry about the system, just create something completely new and completely independent. So eToro, we're a regulated financial entity. We are playing by the rules were regulated in multiple countries. We are trying to have a voice, and that is to work with regulators, work with governments, you know, work our way in within the system and innovate by providing, you know, all these kind of cool products and features that, that we've built throughout the years, but from within the system in partnership with stakeholders. I think DeFi is the ultimate exit from the existing financial system. Is they're not worried about, you know, the OCC. They're not worried about New York DFS. They're not worried about regulators or lawmakers. They're just trying to create something that no one can control. And that, I believe, completes the vision of what Bitcoin was trying to do. Basically, it's an exit from the existing rails that is completely censorship resistant. No one can touch it. No one can manipulate it. I believe that these, that Bitcoin and, you know, the inevitable winner or multiple winners in DeFi are complementary, and people would eventually be able to using pseudo-anonymous identities, participate in an economy that is much more sophisticated, much more innovative, with new capabilities, new opportunities, and without worrying about existing stakeholders trying to get in the way because no one really controls that. I think that is the, that speaks directly to what the people that started Bitcoin were all about.
So I agree with that general, you know, thesis that Guy laid out. I think, you know, the bigger concern that I have here, and this is why I think stablecoins are so exciting, is the fact that we need to bring in more retail. We need more fiat on ramps. We need to attract new people into the space. And we, when we have DeFi protocols, you know, getting hacked 5 times in a quarter, that kind of, you know, is a bad look for crypto, right? And you know, these are not platforms that are necessarily easy to use. These are not platforms that, you know, have giant user bases. And while I think in theory they are nice, I think they are still very, very early. And right now the people that are using it are very much VCs that have put their money in a lot of these things, have gotten in earlier than others, and are just taking money from one place and bringing it to another and plopping it back and forth, making a ton of money off of retail and then running. And I think it's still really early. I think that likely we have under 20,000 total DeFi users in the entire world, you know, as opposed to tens or twenties, you know, million people that are actively holding and interacting with Bitcoin.
Very interesting perspective. Let's hop on over to some of the trends and rankings of these different coins that you were spotting for Q2. So I want to know what were some of, like, you know, at a high level, you know, what was the strongest coin of Q2? And what was it that was really a standout in that? Did you see, you know, there were more investors in there, or there was just bigger money behind it? And what was really driving this? Maybe Josh could field this one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the first one is Cardano, right? I mean, Cardano has, you know, the, you know, Shelley coming soon. And so Cardano went up by 175% this quarter. But I mean, you know, it depends on the metric, right? You know, something which is awesome and definitely want to highlight, you know, to Guy and the rest of eToro's team credit, is the fact that Bitcoin saw over 900,000 new followers on eToro this quarter, which is wild. That's on one platform. You know, eToro is obviously a massive platform, and Guy, correct me if I'm wrong, with, you know, somewhere in the realm of 13 million global users.
14
already. Yeah. Every time I mention it, it goes up by a million.
Add a million, baby.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, 900,000 people now following Bitcoin, and actually 900,000 people followed ETH too. So it's not just Bitcoin. So to highlight kind of both those, but if we look at, you know, if we look at social trends, for example, let me pull it up here. In terms of tweet volumes, there are actually 4 coins on eToro that saw spikes. First being Dash, then Cardano, Litecoin, and Stellar were the only 4 coins that saw spikes. But across the board, I mean, some interesting, you know, facts. One being Tezos was the only coin on eToro that saw a higher percentage of eToro users investing in this quarter than the prior quarter. And that should obviously be caveated. And I think Guy did this well earlier with the fact that eToro has made a global marketing effort, you know, focused on commission-free equity trading, which is why, you know, people may have moved to trading Tesla and other assets. But Tezos saw a 75% increase on followers on eToro this past quarter, and it was the only coin on eToro that had more investors than the prior quarter. So, thing to note as well.
Wow, that makes me think. You know, when you see the boat get loaded up like that with so many new followers, is that a good signal of, you know, maybe a trend continuation? Got more investors behind it, more excitement, or maybe a trend top, right? Everybody is getting into that currency. Seen in the past, you know, that price has risen so hard and so fast in, you know, Q4 and Q1 that maybe the top is in for that. You just don't know.
Well, I mean, think about it this way, right? If each of those users is putting $1,000 in, that's $1 billion in new capital into Bitcoin just on eToro in a quarter. That's massive.
That's nuts.
All right. This question is posed to everyone here, but we're going to start with you, Guy. What are your predictions for Q3? Not necessarily in terms of price, but what are the trends that you think are going to unfold this quarter?
So one thing that I would like to highlight is how much good can one person do when it comes to regulation and legislation, if they're at the right place at the right time. So, you know, Brian Brooks going over to the OCC, and then the OCC subsequently issuing a letter saying that banks, U.S. banks, which I believe enjoy, you know, probably the most trust globally, maybe Swiss banks a bit more, right? But still, can custody crypto for their customers. is just a testament for how badly we need more people in these positions to do the right thing. So I won't say a prediction, but I would say that if during Q3, given the fact that Jay Clayton is about to vacate his seat to go serve in the Southern District of New York, and if Hester Pierce will be nominated to be the chairman or the chairwoman, then I think that, I mean, she won't have a lot of time to do a lot by the time we'll have the elections. But if she will be nominated, I think that shortly thereafter, you will see more institutional investors be more confident in crypto in general and formalizing their strategies with regards to the space. They will just have more comfort because of what I predict to be very positive statements about this space and about Bitcoin ETF and all sorts of other things coming out that I think it will make a very big difference in the institutional space with regards to crypto. And then, you know, subsequently, obviously, with retail investors in the US, but also globally, given her proposal for Safe Harbor, for SDOs and you know and things of that nature. So I think that's in the cards. I would say the chances are good. And if that would happen, I see just a lot of really kind of positive moves in the you know it, similarly to what happened with the OCC at the SEC and therefore projecting for the rest of the market and the rest of the world to get into crypto.
Yeah. So, you know, I think Guy is totally spot on there. You know, one thing that I want to add, and that's kind of interesting in context of the movement that we've seen the last 2 days, I just looked at what the most frequently used word on Twitter was surrounding Bitcoin, and it's gold again today. And 68% of those tweets are positive. So when Bitcoin is used in the same context as gold, 68% of the time say that's been positive, with over, you know, 50,000 overall tweets mentioning Bitcoin. You know, there were 3,000 of those that also mentioned gold. So it's becoming a big part of the narrative. And something that we didn't see in Q2 was Bitcoin behaving risk off, right? Bitcoin and the S&P 500 in June, for example, moved in the same direction on 62% of days. And if you compare that to the S&P and gold, the S&P and gold only moved in the same direction 35% of the time. That said, what we saw was Bitcoin sentiment and gold sentiment being the most correlated that they've ever been. So in other words, on the same days, investors were positive about Bitcoin and positive about gold. And likewise, you know, on the same days, investors were negative about Bitcoin and negative about gold. And I think that the stock market really hasn't made much sense. This past quarter, right? You know, when Davey Day Trader can go pick out three letters from a Scrabble bag, buy any freaking stock, and the stock goes up by 20%, that doesn't make any sense, right? That fundamentally doesn't make any sense. And I think there's going to be some form of correction in the stock market because our economy cannot be struggling so badly where, you know, no gyms are open and people aren't flying on airplanes and, you know, you can't, you know, like there's nothing. There's nothing.
You can't go out to a freaking bar.
Right. You can't do anything. And the stock market is, you know, at highs, right? It fundamentally doesn't make any sense. And I think there is inevitably going to be some form of correction. And I think the fact that investors are starting to look at Bitcoin as a digital gold, you know, that is going to be massively bullish for Bitcoin. And once the market starts correcting and all this new, you know, all these new retail users on platforms like eToro that have come in and started with equity trading, I think a lot of them are then going to go towards crypto. And I think that is going to be the most bullish development of Q3 and Q4 looking forward is the fact that stock market makes no freaking sense. It has to at some point correct itself. And Bitcoin is just waiting there. It's ready.
I just want to add to that. I think there's my hypothesis with regards to why gold and Bitcoin are so correlated in terms of sentiment is because there's a group of young people or younger generations. And when they think about inflation and when they think about hedging, they think about Bitcoin and then there are older generations, right? Baby boomers and the like. And when they are concerned about inflation, they are flocking to gold. And when they're thinking, they're basically trying to solve the same problem, but using two different things. And so eToro, which is kind of millennial friendly, where that's our kind of target audience. We are looking for these, young investors, millennial investors to come in and trade. We are there to satisfy the demand for hedging against inflation and for seeking that uncorrelated asset to those type of folks. But when it comes to older people, they are flocking into gold. I think that at the end of the day, once things will get, and I hope it won't happen, but once things will get ugly, you will see that generational shift. You will see sentiment being correlated, but you would see the action being different for older people and younger people. Older will go and buy gold. Younger millennials will go and buy Bitcoin.
I think that's exactly what's going to happen, actually. That's a very, very, very well said. And to kind of close us out here, one of my favorite parts of the report was from the quarterly contributors. And you guys had some people speak about, on-chain trends. And we'll kind of talk a little bit about that before we get out of here. We had you guys speak about Telegram settlement and kind of the future of cryptocurrency enforcement. And then we had a conversation, you guys had a conversation with Justin Sun of Tron. So, Guy, pick one of those three quarterly contributors that you really, really, you know, liked and had some standout impressions from. And what are some takeaways there?
So I actually want to talk about, Justin and Tron. As you know, there was a not so long ago, Justin and Yoni, our founder and CEO, were sharing lunch with Warren Buffett. And this is after Justin, won the opportunity to do that by making a donation and so on and so forth. And I think that it was interesting to see just this group of crypto, pioneers kind of congregating together with Warren Buffett and talking about investing and trading. And I think that I think Justin too understands, much like Yoni understands, is how do we bridge these two worlds together? How do we make something like Tron and how do we make something like eToro help bridge those two things together? And so I think the perspective of Justin in terms of how he sees the world, but also understanding the importance of bringing people like Warren Buffett into the table, bringing people from, you know, traditional finance into understanding the value of what is being contemplated here is so important. So I really appreciate the fact that he contributed. I really appreciate the fact that he invited Yoni to join him to the to that lunch. And I think we will continue to see that, not just from Justin and from eToro, but from other market participants who are really trying to, you know, get those bridges built. And once they are built, then you can see that giant, I think, transformation that we're all, you know, hoping for, from traditional rails into new rails, from the old world into new world. And it's just going to, you know, make everyone's lives a whole lot better. So I just wanted to make that general statement about Justin.
Yeah. And look, I think we're giving away a lot of the good and the meat in the report. So I don't want to dive too far into depth on the quarterly contributor sections, because I think they all deserve a full and proper read through. You know, George from Kroll does a really good job at talking about what the Telegram, you know, settlement means for future cryptocurrency enforcement actions. And I really like what Philip Gradwell of Chainalysis, you know, did in terms of going in a deep dive on, you know, into on-chain data. There's a couple points that I'll pull out from there. The first is just the supply of each of the top five cryptocurrencies, which haven't moved in over 52 weeks. And something interesting that he pulled out was the fact that 56% of Bitcoin hasn't moved in a year. 63% of Bitcoin Cash hasn't moved in a year. 62% of Litecoin hasn't moved in a year. 54% of ETH hasn't moved in a year, but only 3% of USDT hasn't moved in a year, which means that, you know, people are holding these assets. You know, in the case of Bitcoin, 56% of the asset not moving means people are holding it and, you know, believing in it as a store of value. Whereas, you know, I think, you know, to the point earlier that we made about stablecoins, are USDT is clearly just a better payment mechanism, which is why only 3% of the supply is, you know, hasn't been moved in over a year. I don't know why you'd be sitting on USDT for that long in a cold wallet, really. But, you know, to each his own.
Forgotten private keys.
Exactly. It's probably that, honestly. But lots of really interesting things there. And, you know, there's also a really great section where we brought on, you know, the managing editor of Cointelegraph magazine. You know, we brought on the CEO of CryptoSlate, the managing editor of Crypto Briefing. We've asked, you know, them and, you know, a bunch of other people in the industry about, you know, the biggest threats and opportunities to Bitcoin. And, you know, they go into a lot more depth than we're obviously going to have time here. So definitely go check out the, you know, the report. It's called The Tie Quarterly on eToro. If you search for it on Google, I think that's the easiest way to find it. But yeah, just, you know, kind of throwing that in there and making sure everybody who contributed gets, you know, their fair share.
Awesome. Well, Josh, Guy, we could not thank you enough for spending this last entire full hour with us today to talk about the awesome state of crypto Q2 report that you guys put together. When I was going through it, my jaw was on the floor the entire time. So guys, I highly, highly, highly recommend you go to our friends, eToro.com, and sponsor as well. Go over to eToro.com, find the quarterly report, and fill up that head with a ton of knowledge. You guys will not be disappointed. Guy, we hope you have a great evening over in Israel. And Josh, I hope you have a wonderful day down here in Southern California. Take care.